From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Video journalists John Alpert and Marianne DeLeo have shot wars in Central America, Cambodia, and Iraq. They've documented crimes in progress and homeless families living in garbage dumps. You may have seen their work on the Today Show or on HBO. On today's Fresh Air, a talk with Alpert and DeLeo about risking their lives to record big stories on little camcorders. Also, director Tim Burton talks with us about his movies Batman, Beetlejuice, Pee-wee's Big Adventure, and Edward Scissorhands, which is just out on video. And jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new record by Rolling Stones drummer Charlie Watts that pays tribute to Charlie Parker. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Fighting continued today in Yugoslavia as the country's new federal army chief ruled out the possibility of a truce until his troops have regained control of the secessionist Republic of Slovenia. Slovenia's president, Milan Kučan, said earlier today that his republic would observe a unilateral ceasefire. The State Department said today that the United States could support peaceful independence for the secessionist republics of Slovenia and Croatia. Spokeswoman Margaret Tutwiler stressed that the independence must come about as the result of a peaceful process. A group of prominent Soviet politicians, including the former foreign minister Eduard Shevardnadze, today formally announced a new political movement designed to challenge the Communist Party's grip on power. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Moscow.
The movement is scheduled to hold an organizing meeting in September when its leaders hope to unite supporters into a party working for further economic and political reforms. Shevardnadze told reporters today that such a party is needed to defend democratic changes already achieved in the Soviet Union. A spokesman for Mikhail Gorbachev said the Soviet president welcomes the group as long as it supports democracy and his policy of perestroika. But a political collision with the Soviet president seems inevitable if Shevardnadze's group eventually does create a new party to rival the communists, whose leader is Gorbachev. Shevardnadze today urged other reform-minded communists to join his movement, and he hinted strongly that he himself may soon resign from the Communist Party. I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
Israel today continued to expand Jewish settlements in the occupied territories despite sharp criticism from President Bush. Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
Israeli officials said they have no intention of changing Israel's settlement policy. In fact, two senior officials were in the West Bank today attending ceremonies marking expansion of Jewish settlements. Housing Minister Ariel Sharon speaking at the dedication ceremony for a new neighborhood in the northern West Bank settlement of Mavot Dotan said that settlements were not an obstacle to peace and in fact were an obstacle to war. Defense Minister Moshe Arons inaugurated a clinic in the West Bank town of Ariel. President Bush yesterday sharply attacked Israeli settlements, saying they were counterproductive and that Israel had given a commitment not to build more settlements. Sources in the Prime Minister's office said Israel had never made such a promise. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Gradstein in Jerusalem.
Stock prices were up again today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 14 points to close at 2,972.72. Analysts said that most of those gains came on a sharp rise in Walt Disney Company stock. Advances edged declines in moderate trading. This is NPR News. Exiled Iraqi opposition groups called on Kurdish rebels today to break off their autonomy talks with the Iraqi government. The call came as opposition leaders concluded a four-day meeting in Damascus. The Kurds are now the only Iraqi opposition group that's negotiating with Saddam Hussein's government. Although the Kurds rejected the latest Iraqi autonomy offer, saying that it contained too many conditions, the Kurds were preparing to send negotiators back to Baghdad. A Shiite Muslim opposition leader said the other opposition groups hoped to get the Kurds to join them in underground resistance aimed at overthrowing Saddam. Actress Lee Remick died of cancer today at her Los Angeles home. She was 55. Remick's career spanned four decades in feature films, television productions, and on Broadway. From Los Angeles, NPR's Wendy Kaufman reports.
Lee Remick's most famous role was perhaps the alcoholic wife in the feature film Days of Wine and Roses. Her co-star in the film, Jack Lemmon, called Remick the embodiment of grace and said knowing her and working with her will remain one of the most joyous experiences of his life. Though Remick never played what she called a down-and-dirty role, her range was broad. In 1986, she won an Emmy for her portrayal of Eleanor Roosevelt in the PBS drama Eleanor, in her own words. Unlike many of her contemporaries, Remick moved frequently between television and features. "I just look for stuff that interests me," she said, adding she didn't like to repeat roles. Lee Remick had been ill with kidney and lung cancer for more than 2 years. Her family was at her bedside when she died. In Los Angeles, this is Wendy Kaufman reporting.
There were more signs of economic recovery today in the statistics released by the government. The Commerce Department said that factory orders were up in May for the second month in a row. Orders for manufactured goods were up by almost 3%. The news supports yesterday's report from the nation's purchasing managers showing that manufacturing activity picked up in June for the first time in a year. I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Video journalists John Alpert and Marianne DeLeo have built reputations by getting into international hotspots other reporters can't. Alpert was the first American allowed to film inside Castro's Cuba and post-war Vietnam. He and DeLeo filmed while under fire in the Philippines. They took their cameras on shoplifting sprees with crooks in New York City for a documentary on crime. In 1972, Alpert co-founded the Downtown Community TV Center for inner-city youth and community organizers in New York. Marianne DeLeo began working there in 1980. Although they see themselves as video activists, for several years they were also under contract to NBC's Today Show. Their relationship with NBC was terminated a couple of months ago when the president of NBC refused to air their footage from Iraq. They had ignored Pentagon press restrictions and entered Iraq with anti-war activist Ramsey Clark. Marianne DeLeo directed and produced their latest documentary. It's called Rape, Cries from the Heartland, and it will begin airing on HBO tonight. John Alpert served as executive producer. DeLeo focused on rape in Memphis, Tennessee, where she traveled with the police to the scenes of the crimes. Seven women agreed to be interviewed and allowed DeLeo to follow them through rape counseling, gynecological follow-up exams, and police questioning. I asked DeLeo how she convinced the women to talk on camera after the rape.
The police would always make the initial contact or the Memphis Rape Crisis Center. So I didn't jump out with the police with the camera, but I sat in the car, and they would go and talk to the victim, and then at the end of their conversation, they would say, by the way, there is this woman here, and she's got a camera, and she's making a documentary, and if you want to talk to her, she would like to speak with you. And that was the beginning of the difficult part, because then I had to go and sit with a woman who had just been raped and say, I know this is a really painful moment, and this is probably the last thing you want to do, but here's what I'm doing and why I think this is important. And I was surprised, really. I thought when I first got out there that maybe absolutely no one would agree to this, that it was, like you say, probably the last thing someone wants to see is somebody with a camera. But I felt that if I could do it in a way that was as unobtrusive as possible and not interfere or not question the person any more than they were being questioned, because they were being questioned by the police and by the nurses and by all kinds of people, that maybe that would make it not easier, but as best as could be expected in that situation with a camera.
Marianne, I know that you went into this story feeling, probably already informed about rape, and most women, whether they've been raped or not, have an understanding of what a horrible violation it is. But what did you learn that you didn't already know?
I don't think I was prepared for the brutality of the crime and seeing people completely beaten up, bruised all over, and some people bleeding, and the range of the victims that you're not exempt. I think when the people at the Rape Crisis Center told me that, when I asked them, well, what's the youngest victim, and they started talking about somebody who was a baby who was a few months old, I just was absolutely shocked. I couldn't believe that that could happen. And I just saw so many children come through that center every day. I found that really shocking and something that when I thought about rape, I didn't think so much about that.
Well, the movie that we're talking about is called Rape, Cries from the Heartland. It's a documentary that airs this month, premieres tonight on HBO, and my guest, Marianne DeLeo, is the director. My other guest, John Alpert, was the executive producer of this documentary, and they've made many documentaries together over the past few years. Let me ask you both to describe how you see yourselves as journalists, what your approach is to journalism, and how you think that compares to network TV reporting.
Well, we come from a completely different background from many of the reporters. No formal training in journalism, and for many years, I have to confess that we did not walk around presenting ourselves as reporters. We came from the streets of New York City. We were amongst the first people to begin to use these little tiny camcorders back when they developed in the early 70s, and we were looking on the news at the way in which our community was covered, and they never covered any of the issues that really affected the people. We had horrible health care in our community. This is Chinatown. The schools were falling apart. The elections were always fraudulent and rigged, and we began using our camera to document the things that were happening in our community. And we played our tapes back on the streets to the people from a truck. And if they didn't like the tapes, boy, they just walked away and we'd be showing these tapes to an empty sidewalk. And that's really the school that we came from. And it wasn't that here we are, big, sharp network reporters, I'm here for 2 minutes and goodbye. We were working within our own community amongst our peers and using television to help improve people's lives. And to some degree, we've always tried to maintain that spirit. And I think in that way, we differ from other reporters. If you look at our reports, we don't appear on camera. We don't think that people care to see us standing on a balcony in Baghdad or standing by the side of the Mississippi River in Memphis. They want to see the people who are the subjects of our program. And it's a very personalized style. We're friendly, normal people. We don't have a closet full of interesting and fancy clothes. We don't own a Burberry raincoat like many of the other reporters. And we're just folks.
Now, you say you don't appear on camera, but you do appear on the audio and asking questions or commenting or narrating. And John, I want to play an excerpt of the footage that you brought back from Iraq. And this is a part where you're in Basra, and you've just walked into the Sheraton at the Basra, and you're speaking, you're asking a question of the two hotel clerks at the check-in desk.
Who pays you guys? Is Sheraton still paying you?
Yeah, Sheraton, yeah.
But how many customers do you have? Do you ever have any guests?
No, guests about 20.
21, since the war started?
Yeah.
While we're eating dinner at the hotel, a bomb landed down the street. We went over the next morning.
Well, boy, they really nailed this neighborhood.
Most probably he was trying to hit this bridge.
Oh, you think he was trying to hit the bridge over here? But if they were trying to hit the bridge, they missed.
They missed it the second time.
Oh, yeah?
They just missed the hospital across the way, and the frustrated residents want to blow up the bridge themselves to avoid further attacks.
What do you think, you?
What's your idea?
I think you're pretty angry. Yeah?
Angry. All angry.
So I think what we just heard is really vocally the opposite style of the authoritative, objective reporter. This is ultra-colloquial, the way you're speaking on here. Why do you want to be that direct and that colloquial?
I'm afraid I am who I am. And I don't think that I'm a person with any more extraordinary authority or insight than anybody else. I'm just an average American who's in a strange place. I feel compelled to try and find things out, especially in a situation where I know it's our planes, our tax dollars at work here, and I want to know what's going on.
If you're just joining us, my guests are John Alpert and Marianne DeLeo, award-winning video journalists who for many years reported freelance for the Today Show. Alpert co-founded and runs the Downtown Community Television Center in Manhattan. And DeLeo directed the new documentary Rape, Cries from the Heartland, which will debut on HBO tonight. Marianne, you've risked your life more than once to report on a story. Give me an example of a story that you felt was worth taking that kind of chance for.
I think every time I take it, I think it's worth it, or I wouldn't take it. I always think about the Philippines because that was a situation where John and I felt that it was very possible we might die there, and it was very frightening. But I felt that it was, we were with the New People's Army in the mountains, and we felt that this was a perspective that wasn't being shown on American television, and it was really important that we show it.
Well, how do you manage to roll the camera or take photographs while you're under fire?
It's difficult. I have to say that I think John's been more successful, maybe because he's had more experience. I don't think my photographs were as good as the video. I mean, the video was exceptional. You just do it. Some part you're not thinking about the danger. You're just thinking about all the things that are going on in the viewfinder and what angle you need to get and what you're trying to show and how you're going to be able to do that.
John, what's your approach?
You know, the first couple of times we were in a situation and there was gunfire and danger, I have to say that I was really scared. I had assured myself that when the shooting started that I was going to stand right up and start filming, but I just bit the dust and was crawling around in a cow pie. This was in Central America. And I was somewhat ashamed at my natural fear and I guess was determined that when the situation presented itself again, I wasn't going to be chicken. And I think this was one of the things that propelled Marianne and I forward in the middle of this battle, is that we just didn't want to hide there behind a rock. We wanted to be able to capture and capture it up close. And a lot of times people will also try and criticize your war reporting and saying, nobody's that stupid, nobody's going to film this, it's got to be fake. And we wanted to make sure that we were close enough there so that people could actually see the horror of what was going on and would know that it wasn't fake and would really understand the turmoil that was going on in the Philippines. So we just pushed ourselves. After it's over, you start shaking. At night when you try to sleep, you see the dead bodies and you see the blood. But while it's actually happening, you're able to push yourself forward.
If you're just joining us, my guests are Marianne DeLeo and John Alpert, award-winning video journalists, and who for many years reported for the Today Show. Alpert co-founded the Downtown Community Television Center in Manhattan, and DeLeo directed the new documentary Rape Cries from the Heartland, which debuts tonight on HBO. More after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Journalists Marianne DeLeo and John Alpert are my guests. Marianne, you've been in tight spots in different countries, in different cultures, you know, in cultures where women would never be part of the military and in countries where women are a part of the guerrilla troops. Are you treated differently depending on the culture that you're in? Have some people in one culture rush to protect you and other people figure, well, women take care of themselves, you know?
Yeah, it's different in different countries. I was surprised in the Philippines that there kind of weren't more people there to protect me. But sometimes it's a country that doesn't have a good reputation for treating women well. And it's hard to explain to somebody else. I don't think really John can understand it, but there are very subtle things that you are just invisible and what you say doesn't matter and people ignore you, and it's not about sort of protecting you, but it's about that you have no power in their society, and so therefore you are not seen. And that's very hard to deal with.
Give me an example of what you mean.
I would say in Iraq that was definitely the case. The people there did not talk to me much about what we were doing and what was happening, and I don't even think they felt necessarily threatened by whether I was taking photographs or whether I had the video camera or not. I was a woman, and I just felt that they didn't think I was significant, really.
Does that ever help you because people won't be threatened by your presence since you don't count?
Well, maybe in this case, because John and I were driving out of Iraq and were on a small road and drove into this little town called Heat. And we both got out to take a picture of a gas station that was closed down, and I had a still camera and a video camera on my shoulder, and John had a video camera. And we both started to film things, and all of a sudden there were a few cars that drove up, and a guy with a gun got out and pointed it at John's head. And everybody pretty much ignored me that I had this other camera, and they just kind of surrounded John. And We tried to calm them down, but they arrested us anyway, and never really talked about that there was a still camera and another video camera involved. They just took this one camera that John had been holding and turned it over many, many times and talked about that this is war and you can't do this, and this man's family was killed, and he thought John was an American pilot. But I felt as though they really didn't focus on me as a journalist at all, which was, I guess it protected me in some way, but it's not a good feeling at any moment that you're not visible.
Right. If you're just joining us, my guests are Marianne DeLeo and John Alpert. They're award-winning video journalists who for many years reported freelance for the Today Show, and Alpert co-founded the Downtown Community Television Center in Manhattan. DeLeo directed the new documentary Rape, Cries from the Heartland, which will debut tonight on HBO. In all the years that you've been a journalist, do you ever feel that you were duped by a source that you trusted?
We've gotten to the point that we know most of the tricks. And we've been around the block so many times in so many different places that we've got a darn good idea whether something's real or not. And when somebody's in the process of tricking us, we usually figure it out, and either we point out to them that they're trying to dupe us and we won't accept it, or we figure some way to get around it. An interesting example was when we were in Cambodia. And we were with the Vietnamese and Cambodian armies on the border there, and they were under attack by the Khmer Rouge. And as good red-blooded reporters would do, we kept on insisting that we wanted to go to the front and we wanted to see the real fighting. And they said no, that they wouldn't take any reporters to see that, that it was too dangerous and too strategically sensitive, and we kept on insisting. So after about 3 days, they said, okay, we're going to the front. We got real excited. And they put us in a truck and they drove us down the road and left us off in a rice field. And we said, well, this doesn't seem like the front because we've been driving past this location two or three times this past week and it didn't seem like it was the front. And then all of a sudden we see creeping through the rice paddies the Cambodian soldiers with camouflage on their heads pretending like they were looking for the Khmer Rouge. And they were so serious and they were looking to the left and looking to the
but
right.
They'd stop and pose every time they moved.
And so me and Mary look at each other. We didn't really want to laugh, but we said, now, fellas, this is just not acceptable. It's not real. Either take us to the front, but don't play games. So they said, okay, tomorrow we'll take you to the front. So the next day they drove us down another road, left us off in another rice paddy, and this time they had twice as many soldiers going through the rice paddies, looking to the left, looking to the right. And this continued for two or three days, and finally they said, listen, we're never going to take you to the front. And we said, good, let's stop pretending, and we left. But we've had other times when we've just kept insisting that we will not accept anything but actually going and seeing it ourselves. And eventually you wait them out. It's happened to us, for example, in Nicaragua, where they just kept us in the barracks for weeks and weeks. And then finally they said, all right, maybe the only way to get rid of these people is to kill them off. And they let us go up into the mountains. And we were the first people to actually film the fighting between the Sandinistas and the Contras.
John, you have been criticized for once staging a scene within documentary footage you were shooting. What was the scene and why did you do it?
Well, what happened is we were in Afghanistan, and we had a specific request from NBC to get a footage of the American embassy being closed down and the flag being lowered at the American embassy as the Americans left Afghanistan. And we called up the embassy, and they said, yeah, we're doing this at 10 o'clock. Come on down and take the picture. So at 10 minutes to 10, we arrived at the American embassy, and to our horror, there were groups of reporters leaving the embassy, and as we walked in there, the ambassador was standing next to the flagpole with a flag under his arm, and he said, oh, gee, John, I'm sorry, I forgot to tell you, we moved it up to 9 o'clock, and we're finished. He said, but not to worry, we'll just put it up on the flagpole and take it down again. And I was scared. I was really scared. It was a specific request from NBC. They never ask us for anything. We basically are on our own in these countries. And we had, up to that particular point, a 10-year unblemished record. We had been investigated many, many times. People had accused us of staging things in different countries, mostly out of jealousy or they didn't agree with what we were showing. And NBC had analyzed our tapes upside and down and gotten witnesses to testify that we always had everything exactly correct. This time we didn't. We cheated, and we basically shot ourselves in the foot. And as a result of that, we were severely chastised, and it's almost like a scar that you carry around with you forever. And even though we have tried to more or less dig ourselves out of the hole that we did, that's always going to be haunting us forever. You can look at that and say that it wasn't a significant incident. You can put it in perspective and look at the years and years of completely truthful and honest reporting, and you can say that everybody makes mistakes, but it really doesn't excuse it, and it's something that we'll be ashamed of forever.
Well, is the lesson of that in a way that you can't go into a situation knowing what it is that you want, but rather letting the situation tell you what it is?
No, I think that the lesson to us is that if you miss something, you miss it. And we have a terrific competitive drive. We've pushed ourselves all over the world, gotten places first, and it's been very important for us to be able to bring back things that other people haven't seen. But sometimes you miss it, and in most cases, if you miss it, you just swallow and walk away, and we should have walked away from that one.
Now, you've had a very unusual relationship until recently with NBC, which is that you were freelancers who were submitting reports to them. Not only are you freelancers, but you're freelancers who are known to have a point of view in your journalism, which is something that's really discouraged in network reporting. What kinds of occasions would they turn to you for reports as opposed to their own full-time reporters?
Well, we would be able, I would think, more by sweat and hard work than anything else, to get to places that other reporters couldn't get to. We were the first reporters to go into Vietnam after the war, first in Cambodia after the war. I mean, we can start listing these things, but I don't like thumping our chests. We outworked people, and we would be prepared to more or less eat dirt and sleep outside for weeks until we were able to get to where things were happening. A lot of times, normal, regular network correspondents don't have that luxury. There's a terrific pressure for them to keep reporting in. They're tied to their satellite dishes. At this particular time, if you watched, for example, the coverage of the Persian Gulf, immediacy was the most important thing, not so much the depth of coverage. Who could get on the air as quickly as possible after a Scud missile attack was announced? And so you would see all these correspondents standing in the dark, and there was a race to see who would get on the air first, not with any particularly illuminating type of news, but who was there first. And this type of thing has pervaded and become more and more prominent in news reporting over the years. We ignore that, and we just basically slog our way through the mud until we get the story.
Do you ever worry about your luck running out?
Well, we sure thought our luck had run out in Iraq when this gentleman had the pistol to the side of my head, and I think the only thing that prevented him from killing me was the fact that he couldn't figure out how to get the bullets in the gun. He kept putting it upside down, and the fact that Marianne kept calming the guy down and keeping him from figuring it out and pulling the trigger. So we lost a couple of the nine lives in that particular episode. Sure, you know, if you walk through the fire enough times, you're going to get burned.
Marianne, what did you say to calm this person down?
Well, since I do not speak the native tongue of Iraq, I don't think it's what I was saying. Is that we were all huddled around this guy with his gun, and it was mostly hand gestures. And I wish I could have said something, but I didn't say in words anything. I just showed my concern that things did not have to go to this for us to put our cameras away.
I want to thank you both very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Our pleasure.
And my guests have been Marianne DeLeo and John Alpert, two award-winning video journalists. DeLeo directed the new documentary Rape, Cries from the Heartland, which will debut tonight on HBO and then be shown several more times over the course of the month. And John Alpert was the executive producer of this new documentary. I'm Jerry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and Apple Computer in personal computing, providing the power to be your best. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. When film director Tim Burton was a kid, he liked to make up stories about space aliens and terrible crimes. He liked to fool people. You might say he's still doing the same thing as the director of such films as Batman, Beetlejuice, Pee-wee's Big Adventure, and Edward Scissorhands. Coming up, a talk with Tim Burton. Also, jazz critic Kevin Whitehead reviews a new record by a drummer most associated with rock. Charlie Watts of the Rolling Stones has a new record that's an homage to Charlie Parker. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. In Yugoslavia, a fragile ceasefire collapsed today when fierce battles broke out in Slovenia and massive army movements were reported in Croatia. NPR's Sylvia Pajoli has more on the story.
Fighting escalated today in Yugoslavia as the unraveling Federation's complex political and military crisis turned into total chaos. In the federal capital, Belgrade, the army raised the level of its threats against the breakaway republics of Slovenia and Croatia. In the Croatian capital, Zagreb, the army opened fire on a crowd of 1,000 people who were trying to stop tanks from leaving their barracks. In Slovenia, fierce battles broke out in various parts of the republic, and Defense Minister Janis Janša said Slovenia is at war. This evening, Yugoslavia's federal president, Stipe Mesic, voiced approval for how Slovenia has acted in the crisis. Mesic presented a peace plan calling for a ceasefire, which he said Slovenia has already unilaterally enacted. As president, Mesic is also supreme commander of the army, but today's events indicate that the military is no longer under anyone's control. In Ljubljana, this is Sylvia Pojoli.
And the military chief of staff of Yugoslavia has turned down that latest call for a ceasefire. Earlier today, he had said the fighting would continue until his troops gained control of the country. In Washington, the Bush administration is indicating to Yugoslavia's central government that using force to maintain unity is too high a price to pay. Secretary of State James Baker, indicating concern over the use of force in breakaway Slovenia, said that Belgrade had gone beyond markers that he had set down with Yugoslavia in a visit there 2 weeks ago. Barry Schwide has more.
State Department policymakers almost never admit they are shifting U.S. policy, and they're not admitting it now. But the change in emphasis is obvious. At the outset, administration officials stressed their support for Yugoslavia's territorial integrity, and privately they expressed concern that the diverse republics might tear each other up. But as the central government used force to try to keep the country together, Secretary Baker and other officials began calling for negotiations and restraint. It's a thinly veiled appeal to the central government to make concessions to Slovenia, Croatia, and the other republics, to relax the strings that bind these six republics together as a nation. Mostly, the State Department is urging that the violence cease. For National Public Radio, this is Barry Schwide at the State Department.
And there could be another delay for a Moscow summit meeting because an arms treaty between the United States and the Soviet Union is not ready. Another round of treaty talks has ended in Geneva, with problems still not resolved. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 14 points to close at 2,972.72 on volume of some 157 million shares. Trading today was only moderate. This is NPR News. As the Syrian-backed government in Lebanon tries to extend its authority in the country, fighting with PLO guerrillas has killed at least 19 people. The army has taken 5 villages in the PLO's last major stronghold. Several thousand government troops have made advances, some 25 miles south of Beirut. The government is hoping that extending its authority may lead to an Israeli withdrawal. In Kuwait City, the government is having some success in its efforts to collect illegal weapons stockpiled since the end of the Persian Gulf War. NPR's John Burnett reports from Kuwait City.
Kuwaiti authorities are alarmed at the private arsenals that people have amassed in the last 4 months. Both Kuwaitis and foreign nationals collected thousands of assault rifles, grenade launchers, recoilless rifles, and rounds of ammunition from abandoned Iraqi bunkers. Kuwaitis are demanding that everyone surrender their unlicensed weapons or face a 15-year prison term. Agence France-Presse quoted a Kuwaiti army lieutenant who said fewer than 1,000 guns were turned into his collection point today, and many of those were shotguns registered before the war. The army officer went on to say that Palestinians, many of whom are suspected of collaborating with the Iraqis, will be the first group targeted for house-to-house weapons searches. In Kuwait City, I'm John Burnett.
According to a new commission study, state Medicaid programs should increase fees paid to doctors to encourage more of them to treat poor patients. The Physician Payment Review Commission says that Medicaid pays doctors about two-thirds of the rates offered by Medicare. However, the commission also said that financial pressures on both states and the federal government will make a high fee schedule difficult to achieve in the short term. In trading today in Europe, the dollar moved up against other major foreign currencies. This is National Public Radio News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. Tim Burton directed the film extravaganza Batman, but his first two films were smaller, idiosyncratic fantasies, Pee-wee's Big Adventure and Beetlejuice. He returned to a smaller scale in his latest film, Edward Scissorhands, which just came out on video. The movie is set in a generic suburb, well, maybe not exactly generic. The road at the end of this suburb leads up a steep hill to a Gothic castle. As the movie opens, Diane Wiest is an Avon lady who's having no luck selling her cosmetics door to door. So she drives up the hill to the castle and finds there a young man with wild hair and a sensitive, innocent face who has scissors instead of hands. Edward Scissorhands isn't really human. He was created by an inventor, played by Vincent Price, who used to live in the castle. But the inventor died just before he was going to give his creation hands. The Avon lady takes isolated Edward Scissorhands home to the suburbs. This movie takes the form of a fairy tale. Tim Burton grew up loving monster movies and horror films. I asked him why he created a fairy tale.
Well, I'd always liked the idea of fairy tales. I always liked the imagery and fairy tales, myths, fables, things like Hansel and Gretel and Little Red Riding Hood. Even though I liked the imagery, they never really connected with me completely. And I just always had the desire to, you know, make a fairy tale that was, that had all of the, you know, elements, the visual quality of a fairy tale, but, you know, something that maybe would connect a little bit more.
Connect more by being more alienated.
Well, connect more in the sense that, you know, these things, fairy tales always have this wild sort of very visual imagery, and yet you know there's some sort of psychology beneath it, but yet I always had trouble understanding it. That's why I always liked that Bruno Bettelheim book, because it really, you know, explained and opened up what fairy tales are and what they mean.
When and how did you get the image of Edward as a lonely boy, you know, who'd been created in a laboratory with scissors for hands? What came to you first about that, and what was behind the image?
Well, the image sort of came at the time, I think I was in my late teens or early 20s, and, you know, that time is always very dramatic, you know, mm-hmm. very melodramatic time of life. And I think it came from a feeling of not feeling like I was connecting with anybody. I mean, it's a fairly universal feeling. I didn't see myself as the only person like this. You know, everybody around me seemed to have varying degrees of the same kind of feeling. So even though, you know, I was still a student, I wasn't doing films or anything, I did like to draw. So it did have graphic implications. It didn't have any filmic at the time.
What's interesting to me that as someone who liked to draw, you had this image of a boy who had scissors for hands, who couldn't use his hands in the way that normal people could, whereas for you, your hands were part of your gift.
Well, yeah, hands, yeah, it's funny, you know, you start thinking about things, and I don't know, I start to kind of zone out on things, and I start thinking about hands, and then it starts to get, I remember when I saw this movie, I remember going to a drive-in and seeing Fantastic Voyage. I don't remember that, where they shrink down inside to somebody's body.
Yeah.
And it started to freak me out because I just started to think too much about the inside of my body. So the same thing happened with hands. I just started to think a bit too much about it and had to stop. But it had less to do with hands that it did to do with a feeling of not being able to communicate. Again, since I was always fairly quiet and liked to draw, I would communicate pretty much just by drawings and not by speaking.
Can you describe how the hands for Edward were created?
Well, we wanted to do something that didn't rely heavily on special effects. You know, the most obvious technique would have been to have them mechanical and have like about four guys with cables running them. And since we just wanted to make this a simpler story and not make it so special effects heavy, the person I had do it, Stan Winston, who's great, who's a real good effects guy, designed it with the utmost simplicity in mind, so that the actor could just slip them on and know how it felt to feel that way. I mean, that was the most important thing to me, is that Johnny Depp could put them on and feel it and see what it felt like to have this kind of have these kind of hands. And since he's in every shot, it just made it much simpler. I mean, we'd still be shooting today, I think, if we hadn't done that.
How sharp were the blades on the scissors? And were there any accidents on the set?
Sure. Little pokes. And yeah, I got poked several times. I mean, they weren't real dangerous, but they were as dangerous as he was, you know. even though they were made of a light metal thing, it wasn't, they were still, I got poked a few times.
So were they sharp?
Yeah. I mean, not razor sharp. I mean, I couldn't. I mean, he wasn't giving the crew haircuts and everything, every, you know, 5 minutes between breaks or anything. But they were pretty sharp.
Now, one of the choices you made is really an homage. You have Vincent Price playing the role of the scientist in the castle who creates Edward Scissorhands. Were you a big fan of Vincent Price's movies when you were growing up?
Oh, yeah. Those were the movies that really sort of shaped me and helped me. They were just all those Edgar Allan Poe movies that I just could relate to completely. This just, you know, again, they're like fairy tales. They're abstract. You know, there's something about them that you can relate to, and yet it's, you know, it's certainly nothing literal because, I mean, here's people being buried alive and houses crumbling and caving in, that sort of thing, and people coming back to life. You know, that's not certainly something literal, but there was a very strong feeling, a very strong thing like that kind of connection you can have with a fairy tale that I had with those movies. And, you know, and the first thing I ever did, a short film called Vincent, which was sort of something about him, he narrated, and so it was the first great experience I had in movies too. So it was he's really been great.
Was Vincent one of the shorts you made for Disney when you were working
there?
What was it like for you working for the Disney studios? You started as an animator, and I guess it was when you got out of school you started to work for Disney for a few years. Did you feel that you fit into their sensibility? They have a much more upbeat sensibility than you do.
First year I was an animator's assistant and working on The Fox and the Hound, and it just drove me crazy because, number one, I wasn't really good at it, at that sort of thing. And there, you're really called upon to be the total artist and then the total factory worker at the same time. And I just couldn't make those two sides of my brain connect. It just drove me crazy. So I was very lucky. They let me sort of move on to just doing design work and my own things. And it was really nice of them to do. I mean, they didn't. It's kind of unusual circumstance that they let me do that.
What kind of criticisms would they give you?
You mean on my animation?
Yeah, or on your attitude?
Well, luckily, at the time anyway, animators were seen as eccentric, so you could pretty much hang by your heels from the ceiling and nobody would say much. I mean, I used to spend a lot of time in a little closet just sitting there in the dark. Nobody said too much. That was actually the best thing about it. I mean, you really could act however you want and not get into too much trouble.
Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. And my guest is director Tim Burton, and he made the new movie Edward Scissorhands. He also directed Batman, Beetlejuice, and Pee-wee's Big Adventure. This is Fresh Air. Director Tim Burton is my guest. Do you know why you were asked to direct Batman? You hadn't ever done a big blockbuster before, and this was one of the most hyped and promoted films, I think, in the history of movie making. Were you surprised that you were offered the movie on the basis of Beetlejuice and Pee-wee's Big Adventure?
No, because I had a relationship with Warners, and they knew me, and they knew, I think they felt comfortable with me. I mean, it doesn't, with any kind of movie, and especially one with big budgets, I mean, you know, it's always going to be a gamble. It's no matter who you have. And so, and that's right. And so I was glad that they just, they were always very supportive of me in that way. And I, and they should have been, because I think, you know, once you make the decision to let somebody do something, you better just, you know, let them do it, because that's the way it has to happen. So, I think they just felt comfortable because I'd done two movies for them and basically, you know, had the take on Batman. Batman had been around for like 10 years and with lots of different people attached to it. And, I guess lots of different takes on how to do the movie. And I guess they just liked the take that, we had on it too. So, all of those things combined just, you know, wasn't a problem.
What was the take that you brought to the movie?
Well, you know, there was always the TV show versus the new comic, which was very hardcore and violent and stuff. And I had, you know, I was not a big comic fan, and I basically grew up watching the TV show. And I always felt more like a normal person when it came to Batman, because I wasn't a comic book fan. I liked the TV show, and yet I loved the images of the characters. So I was a real Batman fan. I felt more like a normal, you know, because the factions between, you know, comic book people that are very, very passionate about comics and all hate the TV series, and then most people just know the TV series. The take that we had was somewhere in the middle. It's like to make it big and dark and sort of moody, but not completely cut out the humor, you know, keep it, because that's always been important to me in that. And just to you know, and the Joker was certainly a good avenue for that. So it was, you know, it was the idea to keep it big and dark and dramatic, yet not lose any of the, still have some humor in it.
I thought it was very interesting to cast Michael Keaton as Batman and Jack Nicholson as his nemesis, because there's something very similar, I think, about them facially and also about their acting styles. As a matter of fact, when I saw Michael Keaton in Clean and Sober, he really kept reminding me of Nicholson at his best.
Yeah. Well, they both have the same eyebrows.
maybe that's it. And maybe hairline also. Well, yeah, formerly, yeah, anyways,
both,
before.
They're both actors that just, again, it's my favorite kind of actor. They just do it. You know, they're just fun to watch, and they're fun to work with, and you know, it's just a kind of actor that I really enjoy.
Did you ever try to freak people out when you were young?
Oh, sure. Oh, we had a whole thing going. You know, we'd always prey upon the younger members of our neighborhood, and we faked a alien invasion in the park. You know, with creating a wreckage of a spaceship and footprints and stuff, and had convinced this kid that aliens had landed. I convinced the kids next door that I had murdered my brother. You know, horrible stuff.
Did your brother know about this?
Oh, yeah, no, he we had a fake fight, and I killed him.
Do you see this as the foreshadowing of your career in movies?
Well, yeah, in a way, because I never had the real desire. I mean, I never had the goal that I wanted to make movies. I just like to do things. You know, I like to, I don't know. I like to fool people, I guess.
Well, Tim Burton, thanks a lot for talking with us about your movies.
Sure.
Tim Burton's latest film, Edward Scissorhands, recently came out on home video. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, do you have any new information on Clarence Thomas, the president's nominee for Supreme Court Justice?
Terry, we have some new clarification of his views, I guess you could say, on abortion from abortion rights activists. And we've talked to a person who considers himself philosophically attuned to Clarence Thomas, a fellow black Republican conservative who talks about what he thinks Thomas believes in. We have reports from two hotspots in the world. The shooting has started again in Lebanon and in Yugoslavia, and a report from Bhopal, the site of an enormous industrial accident, Union Carbide, years ago.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Charlie Watts, the drummer with the Rolling Stones, has been a lifelong fan of Charlie Parker, the great alto saxophonist and one of the founders of the bebop movement. Watts has a new record paying tribute to his idol, and jazz critic Kevin Whitehead has a review.
What'll $30 buy you these days? A fat hardback book? Dinner for two at a restaurant whose name isn't French? Four or five tickets to see Robin Hood? At record stores these days, $30 will buy you a copy of Charlie Watts' new box set called From One Charlie. The box is big, record album-sized and an inch thick. It's so big and pricey, you may be puzzled, if not outright ticked off, by how little stuff is inside. There's a sepia print of a William Gottlieb photograph of Charlie Parker, a.k.a. Bird. There's also a little picture book, small enough to slide into a jacket pocket, which you can read in 2 minutes without taking an Evelyn Wood course. It's called Ode to a High-Flying Bird. Watts wrote and illustrated it in 1960 to help establish his credentials as a graphic artist, and it helps explain why he's made his living doing something else. The line drawings would be amateurish by any standard, except when compared with Watts's prose. The story depicts Bird as a little chick hatched from an egg in Kansas City who whistled real good but died young because he ate bad seeds. Here's a sample of the text. Eventually, he was whistling just great. But every time he joined a combo, he found that he did not sound or think the same as the other birds. He blew from his heart. Hey, Charlie, look at me. Don't switch careers to jazz critic, okay? The other thing you'll find inside this $30 box is a newly recorded CD of Ersatz Charlie Parker music with Watts on drums. The CD is a whopping 28 minutes long. Never mind that CDs can hold almost 80 minutes of music. The good news is it features the veteran English alto saxophonist Peter King, a terrific bebop player who's virtually unknown in the States. King plays very much in Parker's style and wrote a few simulated Parker compositions. Thank you. Peter King sounds really good on this session, as does the latest in a bumper crop of young trumpet whizzes, England's 18-year-old Gerard Presencé. The only weak link in the band is Charlie Watts. Bebop, the music Bird helped invent, liberated drummers from metronomic timekeeping, but some of the stuff Watts plays sounds like a caricature of bebop drumming. Charlie Watts says his early ambition was to play with Charlie Parker, but it's safe to say he'd have flunked the audition. Back in the 60s, rockers liked to show they were serious musicians by citing jazz players as their heroes. For example, on the back of the first Birds album, drummer Michael Clark, who's not famous for his formidable technique, proclaimed his gods to be Elvin Jones and Joe Morello. There's a long-standing prejudice among some jazz people that rock and roll is strictly for musicians who couldn't play jazz if they wanted to. I don't subscribe to that theory myself. And the guy who played drums on the Stones' Can't You Hear Me Knockin' shouldn't feel like he has anything to prove. But Charlie Watts' attempt to play bebop only reinforces that old prejudice. Watts says the idea behind the box is to coax listeners into getting themselves some Charlie Parker records. Oh, that must be why it's so expensive. After you lay out 30 bills for this, paying 15 for a Charlie Parker CD will look like a bargain you can't refuse.
Kevin Whitehead is a frequent contributor to Downbeat and Cadence. From One Charlie is on the Continuum label. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Roberta Sherrock, Joan Tui, and Sue Weinstein. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Talbots, retailers of women's classic clothing and accessories through stores and catalogs, 1-800-8-TALBOTS. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, a talk with the great Tony Bennett. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us.
They say that falling in love is wonderful. It's wonderful, so they say. And with a moon up above, it's wonderful.